Dr. Falk, it's a pleasure to introduce you this morning.
Okay, I want to thank Bob for inviting me to come here. I am honored and humbled by the problems that and issues that I've heard about just going around the room. HDF is a technology that plays a small part in dealing with certain kinds of bottlenecks. I had never really thought about HDF in the context of this particular issue, and when Bob first asked me to do it, I wondered, you know, how relevant it was, and then when I dug into it, I realized it's at least 50% of what we deal with, and if we define it broadly enough, it's probably more like 70 or 80% of what we deal with. So I'm going to, in that spirit, going to talk about it. First, I'm going to describe what HDF is in the first sort of a third to half of the talk, and then I'm going to talk about I/O bottlenecks that we deal with, things that we identify as I/O bottlenecks and try to deal with. So I'll start with what HDF is. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. I know some of you are very familiar with it because I know some of you quite well. It's a file format. It's basically two things: a file format for managing any kind of data, and it's a software system for managing data in the format. It's designed for high-volume, complex data. HDF, in some one form or another, has been around since 1988. So we've been working on this problem for a long time. It's designed for every size and type of system. It's open source, open format. And the software library is open, as well as many tools. There really are two HDFs. There's called HDF4 and HDF5. And for simplicity, I'm going to focus on the more recent version, HDF5, which is about 10 years old. So you can think of an HDF5 file as a container into which you can put your data objects. And the idea is that you should be able to store virtually any kind of data object and any mixture of data objects in an HDF5 file. It also contains structures called groups for organizing data objects in the files, so you can present different views of those objects. Data sets are the objects themselves, and essentially they're where the majority of the information, metadata, and data is stored. So the model behind HDF5 is groups that provide structure among the objects, reflecting whatever structure it is that one wants to try to reflect, and data sets, which is where the primary data goes. The primary element of a data set is simply a large data array, a multidimensional array. What gives us its power is it supports a very rich set of data type options, including ones that can be defined by an application. It's completely self-describing, so all of this information is contained within an HDF file. Thirdly, there are very flexible, efficient storage options that one can choose. So the idea behind HDF is that it doesn't just take your data and store it in one way. It stores in a way that's appropriate to what you're trying to do. And when we think about bottlenecks, this can be a very valuable feature. There also are attributes associated with groups and data sets, which is where most of the metadata typically goes. Everything else that you would see in HDF is built essentially from these building blocks. Talk a little bit about the software. The core of the software is the HDF I/O library, and on top of that are tools, applications, other libraries that take HDF and make it specific to a particular application or domain. In terms of users, at the tools and applications level, that's where most data consumers see HDF, and they really see it through a prism or an interface that's appropriate to what they are trying to do. Scientific and engineering applications are written at that level. There are domain-specific libraries, APIs, and tools working at that level. And that's really the most public level at which people see HDF. And what that means is that in many, many cases, people aren't even aware that what's under the hood is in HDF. It could be in XML or some other thing. And then the library itself has two parts. It has an application programming interface where you actually manipulate, read, write, create the objects that I talked about, the groups and the data sets and so forth. And sometimes a power user will actually write an application directly to that programming interface rather than through a library on top of that. And then what we call a virtual file layer, which is where the HDF library actually talks to a file system or an I.O. system. We deliberately made that public and something that people can make their can implement their own modules to largely to address these sort of bottleneck issues that we'll be talking about. And so that will write to the file system, MPIIO, to other layers. And then at the bottom, of course, is a file. And a file actually doesn't have to be a single file on a file system. A file can actually consist of thousands of files that look as though they're one file. So the idea is you've got a container that's containing all of these things, and you have a single view of these things. But under the hood, again, there may be a lot of different things. So the basic philosophy behind HDF is a single platform with a lot of different uses on top, one general format, one library that does all of this stuff for you under the hood, and then various options to adapt I.O. and storage to your data needs, and then layers on top of that, as well as layers below that, that the HDF library interacts with. It's important in the design to try to be able to interact well with other technologies. Sometimes we succeed, sometimes we don't succeed so well. That's something that we work very hard on. And it's also important to pay attention to compatibility because data has a lifetime. A lot of technology, we don't have to worry about that. You just get the latest version or move on to a new version or a new technology. With data, we have to worry about the survival of that data over time, and that's important in terms of format as well as the software that we develop. So HDF has a lot of different uses. Any application that deals with large or complex data is potentially an application that might use HDF. We've counted over 200 different types of applications of HDF just from people who've come to our website and told us about what they do. We estimate at least 2 million users of HDF products. As I said before, many of them are probably not even aware that they're using HDF. Every sector of society, academia, government agencies, industry, so forth. I'm going to just give a couple of examples. Certainly applications that deal with large amounts of data, very large simulations on some of the largest systems in the world. A lot of applications that deal with large imagery, electron tomography, for example. We saw some bioinformatics imagery. This is an area that we're seeing a lot of interest in. A lot of movement towards HDF in the last few years. But it's not just about size. Size is important, and size we have to be able to deal with, but we also have to be able to deal with a variety of different kinds of data. If we're going to try to be able to put everything into one package, how do we accommodate that? How do we design something that can accommodate that well? And that's something that we try to do. This is a picture from colleague that we worked with describing the data used in the CFD codes, you know, everything from element types to functions to coordinate systems. All this stuff has to be able to go into this package. Rama mentioned the Earth Observing System earlier, this is really what's driven HDF mostly over the years, HDF development. And this is a system where you have a number of different satellites. Each satellite has a number of different instruments. Those instruments will collect data in different ways. And yet, when you want to try to use the data, you'll have all these different kinds of data, and you'll need to have it be interoperable. You need to do data fusion. So you need a way to be able to have a single or just maybe a few views of the data that you're dealing with. And that's extremely important us with HDF. Another example is flight testing. We have several different applications in various automotive testing and flight testing and so forth. And this is interesting because you have really two quite different views of the data. When you're collecting the data, there's, you know, you have to worry about high-speed data ingest, multi-stream, multimodal data coming in. How can you collect that in a meaningful way and still keep up with the speed requirements? And then once the data is collected, or even while it's being collected, you need to be able to analyze, query it by time, query it by space. So really, in this case, you need to be able to provide two different views of the data, because even though it's the same data, you're performing different kinds of operations in dealing with it. So that just gives you a kind of a brief introduction to HDF. The talk that I originally put together for this, when I started to practice it, it looked like it was going to take about 2 hours. So there's a whole lot more I could be saying, but hopefully this will give you a sense of what bottlenecks we deal with and how we deal with them. First I started thinking, okay, I need a definition for an I/O bottleneck, so I went to the web and went to Wikipedia and came up with this definition that's based on the definition of an engineering bottleneck, a phenomenon where the performance or capacity of an entire system is severely limited by some aspect of, and I stuck the I/O in there. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that at least for us, there are two types of bottlenecks. The first of which is really a true bottleneck, technology-based bottlenecks, where you're just trying to move the data around quickly from one place to another. And the other has to do with usability and accessibility, and I realize that this is something that we really deal a lot with. And bottleneck may not quite be the word, barrier may be a better word, but it kept coming to mind as I was thinking this through. So the role of HDF in all of this is to try not to cause bottlenecks by the way that we do things, and then also to try to offer ways to deal with bottlenecks when they occur. Where do they occur? I was thinking about that. Well, they occur pretty much everywhere in the whole system. So this is just something that you can't stop thinking about. It's going to happen kind of no matter where you are working, and we'll see some examples as we go through that. I tried to categorize sources of bottlenecks, and I came up with four categories. I'm not sure this is the best four, but given the time I had, I think this will work for starters. Bottlenecks having to do with architectural features with the system that you're working in. Having to do with characteristics of the data and information objects that you're dealing with. Having to do with the operations that you're performing, accessing and operating on your data. And then finally, usability, accessibility bottlenecks, which got me to thinking, you know, the biggest problem area that at least we hear about is beyond, when the data goes beyond the special use of it. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes. So architecture-related bottlenecks, software that does I/O often needs to operate on different systems. Okay, maybe the same software on different systems even. The differences within and among these systems can create I/O bottlenecks as well as solutions. So I'm just going to give you some examples. I had probably 10 or 12 from each of these, and I just chose a few in the interest of time. For example, an architectural bottleneck, there might not be enough memory. So an application might have to continue to swap to disk, okay? In HDF, because of this virtual file layer that I talked about, a file doesn't have to be on a file system. It can be in core, okay? So you can do I/O back and forth from one part of core to another to your application. It appears that you're working on a file system, but you're working in core. In a cluster, multiple processors doing I/O on the same file at the same time. So it's important to have adaptable parallel I/O strategies, for example, collective I/O, where you can merge many small accesses into a large one. So having that capability, a different way of doing I/O, the virtual file layer allows you to do that. A parallel file system may have special features built into it to avoid bottlenecks. So that with, again, with the virtual file layer, you can implement special I/O drivers in a virtual file layer to exploit those capabilities. Sometimes you can, sometimes it's not so easy to do, but it's a good start, and sometimes it works very well. In terms of characteristics of data and information objects, the size, the heterogeneity, how we represent information, these are all potential causes of I/O bottlenecks. In terms of heterogeneity, for example, a lot of times you'll get similar data, but it comes from different sources in different formats, organized in different ways. Okay, and the bottleneck there is how do we make it look in a way that we can combine the data, can use the same tools to look at the data, visualize it, and so forth. And in this case, we're really not talking about changing the technology. Talking about is communities creating common models and then perhaps building libraries that reflect those models, avoiding the need to kind of actually convert the data. Having to convert data often for interoperability, for example, you might have, you know, something as simple as little endian and big endian, or 64-bit and 32-bit floats and so forth. HDF makes it very easy to add I/O filters that can automatically convert the data as it's being read or written. Another characteristic is has to do with size. One of the things that we run into over and over again, and it's just going to get worse as time goes on, is the difference in size between metadata and data. It's really hard to do big I/O and small I/O efficiently at the same time, especially on high-end systems that are tuned to do big I/O. Okay, so one of the ways that we approach that is with caching. Okay, HDF caches metadata and data automatically in order to avoid rereading and rewriting, but also it allows an application to have some control of the cache. It can control when a cache is flushed. It can advise about cache size, replacement strategies, and so forth. So that's a way that HDF tries to help in that area. In terms of representation, different applications need different views of information. That requires transformation of the data, which can be a bottleneck. There might be a need to change a coordinate system. You might want to ingest the data from a flat file or from an HDF file into a database. You might want to change the engineering units on the data. With HDF, the group structure gives you a good running start to have different representations, because you can have different group structures all in the same file. You can build indexes. There are reference data types that allow you to provide different views of the data. And again, these I/O filters can actually operate on the data during I/O and do transformations for you, for example, changing engineering units. In terms of accessing and operating on objects, I/O bottlenecks can occur when data is collected, generated, searched, analyzed, converted, moved. There are probably more verbs there as well. So when we're operating on objects, in terms of sequential I/O, sequential read and write, data from a single source coming in at a very high rate can just be plain too fast. So, you know, that can be a bottleneck. Or you can have data from multiple sources coming in simultaneously. As I mentioned earlier, it could be multimodal and so forth, and that can cause a bottleneck. So with HDF, you can actually use a different file structure for collecting the data if it's coming in sequentially as opposed to coming in some sort of random order. And again, you can also exploit at the virtual file layer system optimizations. For example, there's something called Direct I/O that allows you to bypass system buffers. So you can really tune it to deal with those kinds of bottlenecks. So that's sequential access. In terms of partial access, random access, and so forth, you want to access or operate on part of an object, slice through an object, and so forth. Depending on how, if the data is not laid out in the right way, that may be a bottleneck. And as I mentioned earlier, HDF offers a rich set of I/O options, including partial I/O options, that can recognize patterns well, actually the application has to recognize the patterns and then help optimize for them. It uses chunking. It breaks a data set into smaller chunks that can allow you to slice through arrays more quickly. Accessing a compressed object. If an object is extremely large, you might have to compress the whole object, even if you only want one little piece of it. Again, this chunking strategy allows you to compress chunks and avoid the need to uncompress a whole object. Performing a query about an object or a collection. You can, again, because of the flexibility of HDF, you can create indexes to those collections, for example, store them in the same file, and then build your application so that it can look things up by index rather than going directly to the data. Remote access bottlenecks. This is huge and getting huger. Everything that we've talked about so far is exacerbated when the data is accessed from a distance or over a slow network. The best solution is to try to avoid moving the data. And as it gets bigger and bigger, we want to try more and more to do that. So one way to do that is to send the operation to the data instead of sending the data to the operation, okay? Put HDF software inside the remote data system. Reagan's going to talk about IRODs later today, and we have a very nice project in which we've inserted HDF inside the IROD system so that you can just execute it there. They had to make some changes. We had to make some changes in order to make that work. And another thing is try to implement remote query and access protocols such as OpenDAP and make them friendly with HDF. So here's where playing well with other technologies becomes really important. Finally, on the usability and accessibility area, I call this beyond specialization. Data is collected for specific purposes, and it frequently turns out to have many other uses. That's often not a surprise. You know that's going to happen. But your focus is on collecting the data and its initial uses. Too often, only the first users, the specialists, have the knowledge and the tools to access the data and to interpret it meaningfully. And so this isn't really a bottleneck. This is more of a barrier. And so what are some of the barriers? Well, these barriers can be described in terms of a gap between the producer of the data and the user of the data. Those gaps could be social, political, economic, semantic, temporal, and there are probably several other words we could put in there. The greater the gaps between the producer and the consumer, the greater are the challenges to usability and accessibility. So what are some usability accessibility bottlenecks? I found it most convenient to express these in terms of questions because these are the questions that come up from the user when they're trying to get the data and to use it. First of all, what data do I need, okay, and where do I find it? Now that I have it, what does the data really mean? Is there provenance information? Is there quality information? What tools do I need to access the data? Do those tools exist for my particular use? If they do, how do I use them? These are all difficulties that we hear about on a daily basis from someone who's got some HDF data from somewhere. How do I transform the data to a representation that addresses my information needs? How do I integrate and combine this data with my other data to create new information? Who can help me? So those are some of the barriers, let's call them bottlenecks/barriers in this domain. How does HDF respond to this? Well, the layering of the software to make it accessible at different levels of expertise is very important. If you can have a MATLAB on top of HDF or another application, that can really simplify things well. Developing and promoting standard models and representations within HDF, in other words, working with communities such as the Earth Observing System community and NetCDF and so forth, developing and promoting metadata standards and their representation in HDF, and I should add an API or a tool that will get that for you so you don't have to worry about that representation, providing simple tools to view the data. So very often the real barrier is just getting that first familiarity with the stuff with some simple tool. Providing tools to export the data that's needed, and perhaps only the data that's needed. Usually there's a lot there, and only a small amount may be needed, into other formats, and then in particular working with tool builders, working with others, both the open source builders of tools as well as proprietary builders of tools. And finally, I alluded to this earlier, time, data, keeping data and keeping access to data over time. Ben Kobler is here, and Ben was the guy who first asked me the question about 12 years ago. He says, now that EOS is putting all this data in HDF, how can you guarantee to me that our users will be able to access this data in 80 years? And my response was, that's not my problem, but it is my problem, and it has been my problem for the past 10 years, and it's really one of the main reasons that we've spun off a company and created a nonprofit organization. So one way to address that is to export the data to simple, enduring formats, such as XML. Another, and Rama has supported this project, is to create maps to the data. Actually, have a little XML file that tells you where in this complicated HDF file with all these chunks and compression and all this stuff, where actually is your data and what does it look like? So that if the HDF library and API are gone, long gone, you still have a way of getting to that data. Defining and storing such things as access information packages according to the OAIS standard. It's another way to be able to do that, and some stuff that we've worked on. And finally, to be very tenacious about backward compatibility. Software developers don't want to think about this or care about it. They just want to move on to the latest, greatest thing. So you really have to hold your team's feet to the fire and everyone else in terms of making sure that whatever version of the format the data is in, the software will be able to access that data going far into the future. So to kind of reiterate, our philosophy is a single platform with multiple uses, one general format, one library with options to adapt I/O and storage to data needs, layers above and below to help us deal with bottlenecks, the ability to interact well with other technologies, and strict attention to past, present, and future compatibility. Thank you.